The prophet Joseph Smith went through many great trials in his life, and at one time you may recall that when he was in Kirtland, Brother Behunin came to him and he said, "Brother Joseph," he said, "so many of the brethren have left the church, and not only have they left the church, but they have turned against the church and become some of our most bitter persecutors." He said, "I will never leave the church, but if I do," he said, "I'll move out in the country and buy a little farm somewhere." And then he said, "I promise you that I will never turn against the church." And then Joseph said something that was very prophetic. He said, "Brother Behunin, you do not know what you will do. When anyone joins the Church of Jesus Christ, they leave neutral ground forever behind." And Elder Packer said it in just a little way. He said, "They leave the church, but they can't leave it alone." And as a testimony to you today about the prophet Joseph Smith, I've thought about him and some of the great trials of the pioneers. And one of the things that comes to mind is when George Q. Cannon, a convert, came up the Mississippi River and docked at the dock in Nauvoo. And he was standing on the riverboat looking down on the dock. And he said there were about 200 men waiting for those to disembark who were on the boat. And he said, "If there had been 1,000 men, I would have known which one was the prophet Joseph." And then later on, you remember that there were others who came in great numbers to Nauvoo. And one time, Joseph Smith, feeling that he ought to, in his heart, make sure they came for the right reason, so he put on his oldest tattered clothing, and then he mounted his horse and rode down to meet the Maid of Iowa boat as it came up the Mississippi, with many immigrants from England ready to disembark. And as they disembarked, he took about the first one as he came off and kind of pulled him off to the side, and he said, "Why are you here?" And this good brother said, "Well, because I have joined the Mormon church and I want to come and be in Zion with the saints." And Joseph Smith said to him, "What do you know about Joseph Smith?" And then very humbly this man said, "I know he's a prophet of God." And Joseph said, "What if I told you I was Joseph Smith?" In these old tattered clothing, as the man looked at him, he said, "Then, sir, I know that you are a prophet of God." I think it's interesting as we look back on the life of the prophet Joseph, and that leads into the things I'd like to discuss this morning. Possibly, no greater story can be told than the unfolding of the drama of the pioneers. Converts by the thousands seemed to be relentlessly pulled toward what they supposed was Zion. And I suppose in literal sense it was Zion and many other parts of Zion. The poor, the abandoned, the rich, leaving all worldly goods behind, the educated, and those with limited schooling all came forth. Their unwavering faith in Christ and their commitment to his cause led them on. I should like to share with you some of the experiences that I have studied that have humbled me to the earth. Those brave souls left us a legacy and a rich heritage. No amount of money could purchase what they freely gave. It cost life and limb. It cost great suffering of the most severe kind of heartache imaginable. Theirs was the noblest gift, that of love. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. And then, I suppose, of the great stories of those who came across the plains, Hiram Winters and his wife Rebecca were one. As they came across the plains, Rebecca Winters became severely ill from cholera. Hiram Winters, who was a sub-captain, divided himself away from the 18th Pioneer Company, and they made an encirclement about noon, or just a little before noon, purpose of just waiting on his wife and taking care of her needs. She died just a little after noon. They buried her in a deep grave. And then that night, as they sat together, William Reynolds, a friend of the family, sat up at a late hour. And then he took a chisel, and in a large iron tire from off of one of a wagon wheel, he chiseled in it Rebecca Winters, aged 50. And then they placed this over the grave. And the next morning, as they prepared to roll westward, leaving the frail body of Rebecca Winters behind in this deep grave, Hiram looked back, and seeing the tire iron over the grave, he said, "That grave will remain there forever." And so the pioneers, that particular small sub-band, moved onward. Later travelers and finally settlers in the area did not forget. And when cowboys found her marker, they gave her name to a nearby stream and a spring, and later to a precinct in Scotts Bluff, and finally to a street in Scotts Bluff. In 1900, when the Chicago and Burlington Railroad was being surveyed up the north side of the Platte, their survey crew rediscovered the marker right in the center of their planned grade. Not wishing to disturb the grade, they backed up several miles and moved the line over a few feet so the grave would be beside the tracks. The chief surveyor also sent a notice of his discovery to the Deseret News, and when that article was written, it came to the attention of some of Rebecca's descendants. One was Augusta Winters Grant, the wife of President Heber J. Grant, who served as the president of the church for 27 years. They provided that a temple granite marker from the granite from the temple be placed over her grave in 1902. And then sometime after that, the Burlington Railway had a small wrought iron fence placed around it. And then the foreman, E.F. Despain, had a well dug to water the shrubs and the lawn and the flowers that adorned the grave. Rebecca Winter's grave still stands as a pillar forever in honor of all those noble and brave pioneers who died and were buried in unmarked and lost graves. And thus her monument, as Hiram Winters stated, will remain there forever. Around the time of the centennial, President J. Reuben Clark, who was in the first presidency at that time, gave one of the great pioneer talks ever delivered, I suppose, in the history of the church. And he entitled it, "To Them of the Last Wagon." And let me just give you a small quote from that. He said, quote, "But back in the last wagon, not always could they see the brethren way out in front. And the blue heaven was often that blotted out from their sight by heavy, dense clouds of the dust of the earth. Yet, day after day, they of the last wagon pressed forward, worn and tired, footsore, sometimes almost disheartened, borne up by their faith that God loved them, that the restored gospel was true, and that the Lord led and directed the brethren out in front." Now, here's a great principle. I believe that as we go through some of these other incidents, you'll find that there is a faith that these people had, a purging that came, and a need to feel close to brethren and not compromise the standards. Only God knows the sufferings of every soul who crossed or attempted to cross the plains. Surely these magnificent and faithful souls have stories to tell that would melt the hardest, most granite-like heart. Women nursing newborn babies at their breasts, children walking until their poor little feet would blister and then bleed, fathers and mothers working together in a state of exhaustion, but always, always pushing onward. Perhaps the most touching of all stories are the various accounts of the handcart companies. As you know, the emigrating fund was organized to assist saints to come to Zion. The financial strain on the emigrating company in 1855, only 8 years after the first saints arrived in the valley, was almost impossible. President Brigham Young wrote a letter to Franklin D. Richards, who at that time was president of the European Mission, or the British Isles Mission, and said something like this: "I have been thinking how we could operate another year. We cannot afford to purchase wagons and teams as in times past. I am consequently thrown back upon my old plan to make hand carts and let the emigration foot it and draw upon them the necessary supplies, having a cow or two for every 10. They can come just as quick, if not quicker, and much cheaper, can start earlier and escape the prevailing sickness which annually lays so many of our brethren in the dust. A great majority of them walk now even with the teams which are provided, and have a great deal more care and perplexity than they would have if they came without them. We will only need 90 days, mind you, 3 months, rations from the time of their leaving the Missouri River, and as the settlements extend up the Platte, not that much. The carts can be made without a particle of iron, with wheels hooped, made strong and light. And one, or if the family be large, two of them will bring all that they will need upon the plains. If it is once tried, you'll find that it will become the favorite mode of crossing the plains. They will have nothing to do but come along. And I should not be surprised if a company of this kind should make the trip in 60 or 70 days. I do know that they can beat any ox train crossing the plains. I want to see it fairly tried and tested at all events. And I think we might well begin another year as any time and save this enormous expense of purchasing wagons and teams. Indeed, we will be obliged to pursue this course or suspend operations for aught that I can see at the present. Well, in 1856, the first handcart companies were organized and commenced the journey. The handcarts were made out of Iowa hickory and oak. The oak wood was properly selected and seasoned. The box construction of Iowa hickory or oak and the shafts also. The axles were uniformly hickory. The length of the side pieces and shafts were about 6 or 7 feet, with 3 or 4 binding crossbars from the back part to the fore part of the body of the cart. And the lead space for a man to pull the cart was 2 or 3 feet. When necessary, the wife and or the children would push. The hand carts could be loaded with 400 to 500 pounds of flour, bedding, extra clothing, cooking utensils, and a tent. A 17-pound clothing allotment was allowed per child or per individual, and that meant clothing and bedding, if you would. And then they were allowed 1 pound of flour per person per day. And so if you had 4 in the family, they would have 4 pounds of flour times 90 days trip. It would take about 360 pounds of flour that they would put on the cart, plus their 68 pounds of clothing, 17 times the 4 members of the family, plus their cooking utensils and the tent, and maybe a very special prized, what they would call an heirloom or something that they wanted to bring along and felt that it was worth bringing. And so the total weight would be near 500 pounds, and then they commenced to move. One woman had been given 16, 18 ounces of soap and felt like it was one of the most prized possessions she had at that day. Now, the first 3 handcart companies left in June. The first one left on June 9th, the second one 2 days later, and the third one on June 23rd. They arrived in the Salt Lake Valley September the 26th, and then the second one had caught up, and they arrived also on the 26th, and then October the 2nd. The first company suffered 1 death. The second company had suffered 7 deaths, and the third company, there were none that died on the way. This was no greater and oftentimes less than the regular covered wagon train's mortality rates. When the first 2 companies arrived, all 3 of the first presidency, President Brigham Young, President Heber C. Kimball, and Daniel H. Wells, went up to the mouth of Emigration Canyon and welcomed these marvelous, wonderful Latter-day Saints. And I want to share with you some of the feelings that an eyewitness wrote. As they came down the bench, you could scarcely see them for the dust. I want to have you think about that. When they entered the city, the folks came running from every quarter to get a glimpse of the long-looked-for hand carts. I shall never forget the feeling that ran through my whole system as I caught the first sign of them. The first hand cart was drawn by a man and his wife. They had a little flag on it. And may I say, it may be time to raise this flag. There does come a time to raise a Title of Liberty flag. And again, this kind of flag. And here, after they had made that great journey of 90 days, pushing and pulling, I don't believe we can comprehend what they went through. And here was their little flag, quote, "Our President, may the unity of the saints ever show the wisdom of his counsels." May we have that same faith in President Kimball. There may be nothing more important that I'll say today than just quoting the faith of those people as they inscribed it on a little flag. The next handcart was drawn by 3 young women. The tears ran down the cheeks of many a man who you would have thought would not or could not shed a tear. Well, the next 2 companies that followed after the first 3 were told, "You will go forward at your own risk." It was late. The immigrants had just crossed the Missouri River and paused to recondition their handcarts at Florence, Nebraska. They were wholly ignorant of the country ahead, the rigors of camp life, the impending winter, and the Rocky Mountains. So anxious were they to reach Zion that they chose to commence the journey. The James G. Willie Company left Iowa City July 15th, 1856, with about 500 in the company. 13 days later, the Edward Martin Handcart Company followed. During July and August, they made fairly good distances, but the handcarts were not well constructed, and they began to fall apart, and there was much time lost in repairing them. But they did make fairly good time. And then fall came, and it came early, and the chill of winter brought frosty nights. The consciousness of threatening storms, decreased rations, and insufficient bedding and clothing dampened their spirits. Day after day, they pulled painfully forward. "We traveled in misery and sorrow," wrote John Chislett of the Willie Company. "Sometimes we made a good distance, and other times we were only able to make a few miles of progress. Instead of getting up refreshed, vigorous, and prepared for a hard day of toil, the poor saints were to be seen crawling out in their tents, haggard, benumbed, and showing an utter lack of the vitality which was so necessary. The first snowstorm came. Scarcity of food, lassitude, and fatigue from overexertion soon produced their effects." And then the quote, "Our old and infirm people began to droop, and they no sooner lost spirit and courage than death's stamp could be traced upon their features. Life went out as smoothly as a lamp ceases to burn when the oil is gone. At first, the deaths occurred slowly and irregularly, but in a few days, at more frequent intervals, until we soon thought it unusual to leave a campground without burying one or more persons. Death was not long confined to its ravages of the old and infirm, but the young and naturally strong were among its victims. Many a father pulled his cart with his little children on it until the day preceding his death. I have seen some pull their carts in the morning, give out during the day, and die before the next morning. Each death weakened our forces. In my 100, says this Brother Willie, I could not raise enough men to pitch a tent when we camped. Now it was that I had to exert myself to the utmost. I wonder I did not die, as many did who were stronger than I was. When we pitched our camp in the evening of each day, I had to lift the sick in their wagon, carrying them to the fire, and in the morning carry them again on my back to the wagon. When any in my 100 died, I had to inter them, often helping to dig the grave myself. In performing these sad offices, I always offered up a heartfelt prayer, to that God who beheld our sufferings and begged him to avert destruction from us and send help. So they traveled on. The snowstorms came and the wind was shrill, and it blew furiously about them. The snow was several inches deep, but they had to travel the additional 16 miles to get wood for fire and water to drink. This was the Willie Company, and the Martin Company was still 2 weeks further behind. The Willie Company recorded the snow over a foot deep after the storm. 5 persons lay in the cold embrace of death. They camped and waited for aid to come. Mrs. Jackson in the Martin Company records, "My sister became sick. So severe was her affliction that she became deranged in her mind, and for several days she ate hard, frozen snow." I wonder if this good woman didn't know that the rations wouldn't last, and maybe this was a way she could divert her rations to someone else. She passed away soon. And then there are the others. After that happened, those who were there remained emaciated, and sickness seemed to be constantly about them. As they placed at night, there weren't even sufficient men, as I mentioned, to dig the hand carts or to dig the graves. And they pitched the tents no more than just laying them over them. They had the vault of heaven for the roof and the stars for the companions. The snow lay several inches deep upon the ground. The night was bitterly cold. And he said, "I sat down on a rock with one child in my lap," or she did, excuse me. "I sat down on a rock with one child in my lap and one on each side of me. And in that condition, I remained till morning." And so goes the quote of Sister Jackson. Death continued in the camp. Some died lying side by side with hands entwined. In other cases, they were found as if they had just offered a fervent prayer and their spirit had taken flight while in the act. Some died sitting by the fire. Some were singing hymns or eating crusts of bread. Captain Martin stood over the grave of the last handcart company, of the grave of the departed ones, with a shotgun in hand, firing at intervals to keep the crows and buzzards away from hovering around in midair until they could bury them. Sister Sermon, whose husband was near death and whose two sons were suffering with frozen feet, appealed to Captain Martin. Do you think that the relief party will come and come soon with food, clothing, and shoes? The captain's answer was, quote, I almost wish God would close my eyes to the enormity of the sickness, hunger, and death among the saints. Yes, Sister Sermon, I am confident that as I live, that the present Brigham Young will and has dispatched relief wagons. On October 5th, 1856, General Conference, the commanding figure of Brigham Young, 55-year-old prophet of God, stood at the pulpit in the tabernacle. Said he, and I'd like to have you think about our day and think about the general authorities who have their talks prepared, and then this word. I will now give this people a subject and text for the elders who may speak today and during the conference. He announced, it is this. On the 5th day of October, 1856, many of our brethren and sisters are on the plains with handcarts, and probably many are now 700 miles from this place, and they must be brought here. We must send assistance to them. The text will be to get them here. I want the brethren who may speak to understand that their text is the people on the plains, and the subject matter for this community is to send for them and bring them in before winter sets in. That is my religion. That is the dictation of the Holy Ghost that I possess. It is to save the people. This is the salvation I am now seeking for, to save our brethren that would be apt to perish or suffer extremely if we do not send to them assistance. He then called on the bishops for 60 good mule teams, 12 or 15 wagons, 40 teamsters, 12 tons of flour. Then he said, I will tell you all that your faith, religion, and profession of religion will never save one soul of you in the celestial kingdom of our God unless you carry out in just such principles as I am now preaching you. And then I believe he must have said this with all the fervor of a prophet, go and bring in those people on the plains. Now, at that time, Samuel and Margaret Pucell, husband and wife, were out on the plains with their two daughters, Maggie, 14, and Ellen, 10. Margaret became so ill that she had to ride in the handcart part of the way. So this is the wife of Brother Pucell, and he's now not only pulling the 500 pounds, but his wife on top of the handcart. Her husband grew so weary and weak from the lack of food that this additional burden caused him to slip and fall one day as he crossed the river. Having to travel in the cold, wintry weather with wet clothing, he too became ill and died from hunger and exposure. His wife died 5 days later, leaving 10-year-old Ellen and 14-year-old Maggie orphans. Many died and many others suffered from frozen limbs, among them the Pucell girls, both having badly frozen feet and legs. When shoes and stockings were removed from the girls' feet, the skin came off. Although Maggie's legs were frozen, she would not allow them to do more than scrape the flesh off the bones. But Ellen's feet were so bad they had to be amputated just below the knees. On November 30th, now think about the weather and the time and the season, how cold it is. Oftentimes we're skiing after Thanksgiving. This is November 30th, a Sunday. The saints were assembled in the tabernacle again with President Brigham Young presiding. Having been apprised of the imminent arrival of the immigrants, the Martin Handcart Company, he spoke to the congregation. When those persons arrive, I do not want to see them put into houses by themselves. I want to have them distributed in the city among the families that have good and comfortable houses. And I wish all the sisters now before me, and all who know how and can, to nurse and wait upon the newcomers and prudently administer medicine and food to them. To speak upon these things is a part of my religion, for it pertains to taking care of the saints. As soon as this meeting is dismissed, I want the brethren and sisters to repair to their homes, where their bishops will call them to take in some of this company. The bishops will distribute them as the people can receive them. This afternoon meeting will be omitted. For I wish the sisters to go home and prepare to give those who have just arrived a mouthful of something to eat, and to wash them and nurse them up. You know that I would give more for a dish of pudding and milk or a baked potato and salt, were I in the situation of those persons who have just come in, than I would for all your prayers, though you were to stay here all the afternoon and pray. Prayer is good, he said, but when baked potatoes and pudding and milk are needed, prayer will not supply their place on this occasion. And then he goes on to say, give every duty its proper time and place. Then in a way of the prophets, this great man, Brigham Young, told the bishops to send all of the immigrants for whom accommodations were lacking to his own home. I believe that's exactly what President Kimball would do today if he were in a similar circumstance. There were 66 deaths in the Willie Company and 135 deaths in the Martin Company. President David O. McKay, in an address given to an annual Relief Society conference in 1947, the centennial year of when the Saints arrived in this valley, talked of the criticism given by a teacher conducting a class who commented that it was very unwise to have even permitted the Saints to cross the plains under such circumstances. And they were talking about the Willie and the Martin Handcart companies who had left later than they should have. Some sharp criticism of here's what he said, quote, "Some sharp criticism of the church and its leaders was being indulged in for permitting any company of converts to venture across the plains with no more supplies or protection than a handcart caravan afforded. An old man in the corner," and this was written by President William Palmer, who was present, President McKay said, "sat silent and listened as long as he could stand it. Then he arose and said things that no person who heard him will ever forget. His face was as white as snow, and it was filled with emotion, yet he spoke calmly, deliberately, but with great earnestness and sincerity. In substance, the father above mentioned said, quote, I ask you to stop this criticism. You are discussing a matter you know nothing about. Cold historic facts mean nothing here, for they give no proper interpretation of the questions involved. Mistake to send the handcart company out so late in the season? Yes. But I was in that company and my wife was in it, and Sister Nellie Unthank, whom you have cited, was there too. We suffered beyond anything you can imagine, and many died of exposure and starvation. But did you ever hear a survivor of that company utter a word of criticism? Not one of that company ever apostatized or left the church, because every one of us came through with the absolute knowledge that God lives, for we became acquainted with him in our extremities. I have pulled my handcart when I was so weak and weary from illness and lack of food that I could hardly put one foot ahead of the other. I have looked ahead and seen a patch of sand or a hill slope, and I have said, I can go only that far, and there I must give up, for I cannot pull a load through it, and a wife with a baby in her arms by his side. I have gone to that sand, and when I reached it, the cart began pushing me. I have looked back many times to see who was pushing my cart, but my eyes saw no one. I knew then that the angels of God were there. Was I sorry that I chose to come by handcart? No, neither then nor any minute in my life since. The price we paid to become acquainted with God was a privilege to pay, and I am thankful that I was privileged to come in the Martin Handcart Company. Nor was the cross any easier to bear for our beloved Lamanites. Remember in the days of Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce Indian tribe, and he was told by his father as a young man, Joseph, when I am gone, think of your country. You are the chief of these people. They look to you to guide them. Always remember that your father never sold his country. You must stop your ears whenever you are asked to sign a treaty selling your home. A few years more and the white man will be all around you. They have their eyes in this land, my son. Never forget my dying words. This country holds your father's body. Never sell the bones of your father and mother. Chief Joseph kept his commitment to his father. He would not sign the treaties that other chiefs had signed, consigning their people to reservations. Finally, a commission of five men was sent to speak with Chief Joseph and to make a final settlement. Why, they asked him, did he refuse to give up the Wallowa? He answered by referring to the land as the mother of the Indians, something that could not be sold or given away. We love the land, he said, it is our home. But they persisted, and Lawyer had signed it away in 1863. Joseph had a ready reply that embarrassed them. I believe the old treaty has never been correctly reported, he said. If we ever owned the land, we own it still, for we never sold it. In the treaty, the commissioners have claimed that our country has been sold to the government. Suppose a white man should come to me and say, Joseph, I like your horses, and I want to buy them. And I say to him, no, my horses suit me. I will not sell them. Then he goes to my neighbor and says to him, Joseph has some good horses. I want to buy them. But he refuses to sell. And my neighbor answers, well, pay me the money and I will sell Joseph's horses. The white man returns to me and says, Joseph, I bought your horses and you must let me have them. He said, if we sold our lands to the government, this is the way they bought it. It was determined later that Chief Joseph and his people would be placed in the reservation by force. General Howard was assigned to the task. The Nez Perce made one of the greatest retreat and attack strategies in all of open war. And mind you, they had every squaw and child and infant, in addition to the warriors, and they retreated. They went into the Salmon River country, crossing and recrossing the river. I don't know if you floated the Middle Fork of the Salmon or the Main Salmon. That would not be an easy task. And oftentimes, even General Howard's soldiers couldn't get across and were delayed, but somehow the Indians did. They battled the army of men and won at every turn. They made a march and forced journey from Oregon into Washington, over into Idaho and the Salmon River country, all the way across 1,300 miles to Wyoming and finally into Montana. Finally, they camped near the Bear Paw Mountains, some 17 miles from the Canadian border, where they felt after they had crossed over the border, they would be safe. Troops were sent. A siege that lasted several days took place. Finally, Joseph mounted his horse and, followed by several men, rode up the hill from the camp and across to the army lines, where General Howard and Miles waited for him. He dismounted, handed Miles his rifle, adjusted his blanket to leave his right arm free, and addressing Miles, began one of the most touching and beautiful surrenders ever made. Quote, tell General Howard I know his heart. What he told me before I have in my heart. I am tired of fighting. Our chiefs are killed. Looking Glass is dead. Tuhul Hulzot is dead. The old men are all dead. It is the young men who say yes or no. He who led the young men is dead. It is cold and we have no blankets. The little children are freezing to death. My people, some of them, have run away to the hills and have no blankets, no food. No one knows where they are, perhaps freezing to death. I want to have some time to look for my own children and see how many I can find. Maybe I shall find them among the dead. Hear me, my chiefs. I am tired. My heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever. Now the application of these things to our generation. Winston Churchill said, we have not made this journey across centuries, across oceans, across mountains, across prairies because we were made of sugar candy. James Bond Stockdale, Vice Admiral and retired, spent 8 years as a prisoner of war in the Vietnam prisons. His philosophy and the principles he learned may help make all I have said relevant today. Said he, pressurized experiences have a way of giving us an overload of dilemmas that can't wait for a waffled solution. And then he said, a sort of transformation takes place under pressure. And, quote, prisons have been crucibles of both degradation and creative impulse throughout history. And were they not indeed for Joseph? From this 8-year experience, he said, I distill one all-purpose idea. Now, mind you, if you were in Vietnam in a prison for 8 years without seeing one other living soul, and Robbie Reisner said that it was so severe that he remembered in the little corner where they had a hole that they would use for their urinal, and he would put his head down to that, and he saw one blade of grass, knowing that something was living and kept contact with reality that way. They went year after year without seeing anyone. And he came up with one idea, he said, an idea that is the epitome of high-mindedness, an idea that naturally and spontaneously comes to men under pressure. If the pressure is intense enough or of long enough duration, this idea spreads without the need even for its enunciation. It just takes root naturally. It is an idea that in this big, easy world of yakety-yak seems to violate the rules of game theory, if not of reason. It violates the ideas of Adam Smith's invisible hand, our ideas of human nature, and probably the second law of thermodynamics. And that idea is this. You are your brother's keeper. 8 years, and he said, patriotism didn't bring him through. As much as he loved the country, they punished him too greatly and severely. But he said, knowing that there were other prisoners, that he was his brother's keeper and for their sake had to continue on. 8 years in a prison camp, and Admiral Stockdale tells us that an idea that is the epitome of high-mindedness is, you are your brother's keeper. When he is asked, "What kept you going? What was your highest value?" he answers, "The man next door." We have read and been moved by the prophet Joseph's experience in Liberty Jail. Joseph understood the same principle. If my life is of no use to my friends, it is of none to myself. And Willard Richards stated, "Joseph, if you are condemned to die, I will die in your place." Brigham said, "Go and bring in those people on the plains. We, all of us, are our brother's keeper. When we are endowed with charity and love from on high, then the eternal wealth of our neighbor and brother, son, our daughter, becomes more important than life itself. Ours is a generation of being hunters and fishers of men. We cannot, we must not isolate ourselves from the world. We must go among them and declare glad tidings from Zion. We must give them hope. We must go out on the plains after them. We must respond because we have seen something in his eye that won my love, I knew not why. And when his scanty meal was spread, to be there and to give him our crust, to let him drink from the with thirst, feed his thirst in the water, in the stream, we must, in a very real sense, go to the roof and welcome in the stranger and lay him on our beds and seem, and as in Eden's garden, so to dream. And we must be there to rouse his pulse and revive him and bring back his spirit. And then finally, the time may come when we must decide. I saw him next, a prisoner, doomed to die a traitor's doom at morn. The tide of lying tongues I stemmed. I honored him mid shame and scorn. My friendship's utmost zeal to try, he asked if I for him would die. The flesh was weak, my blood ran chill, but the free spirit cried, "I will." Then in a moment to my view, the stranger started from the skies. The tokens in his hands I knew, the Savior stood before mine eyes. He spake, and my poor name he named, "Of me thou hast not been ashamed, these deeds shall thy memorial be. Fear not, Joseph, Brigham, the Martin Handcart Company, the Willie Handcart Company, the Rebecca Winters, and all others, thou hast done them unto me." Now, I suppose that in my life, the things that I prize most dear are those that have and relate to the prophets and the leaders of this kingdom. I love them with all of my heart and soul. And I believe that I may qualify for what George Q. Cannon said, "There will come a generation who will follow the prophets out of sheer obedience sake." I believe I qualify. I don't question when they speak. I just simply honor them and love them and follow them to the grave if necessary. And then, of course, Christ is the supreme example of all that I hold precious and dear. I love him, and I love you, and I love his prophet, and I commit my soul to his work and the work of being my brother's keeper. I would rather have my children come across the plains and suffer and even die with a testimony, be faithful, never leave the church, to have angels walk with them and push the hand carts, than to have all of the comforts of life and lose their faith. That is my testimony. I love the Lord, and I intend to follow the prophet and follow his counsel in unity with the other brethren. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.